a tribute to a civil rights leader in South Florida, also the future of our cities, and a unique poetry program. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
Once Alcee got rolling and got the crowd with him, you would just sink down in your chair and think, whenever he finishes, Lord knows they're not going to want to hear from me.
Representative Alcee Hastings spent nearly three decades in Washington. We'll take a look at his life as a civil rights leader, a judge, and a congressman. Also, South Florida cities continue to grow rapidly, but is that growth sustainable? We'll speak with a South Florida developer that's rethinking growth. And finally, in celebration of the Yo Miami Poetry Festival, a letter-writing campaign between folks here and people in Puerto Rico. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. For 28 years, Representative Alcee Hastings served in Florida's congressional delegation as a champion of civil rights. Yesterday, the longtime South Florida Democrat died at the age of 84 following a years-long battle with pancreatic cancer. Before serving in Congress, Hastings was a longtime judge and attorney that oversaw a number of cases involving desegregation and voting rights. Here he is in August of last year speaking on a commission to restore funding for the post office.
There come times when it becomes necessary when actions are being taken that affect our constituents and affect something as important as the mail.
Earlier this morning, we spoke with Hastings' colleague in the House, Broward Democrat Ted Deutsch. Hastings had a reputation for electrifying a room with his speeches, which is where we began our conversation.
It's never a great position to be in, to have to follow Alcee, particularly when he built up a head of steam. Alcee, even in those occasions where we were where there are a number of elected officials and you're asked to speak for a couple of minutes, once Alcee got rolling and got the crowd with him and really started preaching about whether it was the need to get out to vote or the need to stand up for people who needed us there for him, or the need to push back against policies that he knew were bad for our community, there'd be this murmur in the crowd, and that's when, as the person who had to come next, you would just sink down in your chair and think, who knows when he's going to stop it. Whenever he finishes, Lord knows they're not going to want to hear from me.
When you finally got the opportunity to be his colleague, you know, in the House, what was it like for you? I mean, how would you describe what you knew of him as a lawmaker and then what you experienced, you know, him as a lawmaker?
Alcee rightfully had a reputation as a civil rights leader. I mean, that's his years practicing law. I mean, the time period in which he fought for racial justice in Florida, and when you go back and look at what he, how he grew up, what he fought for, and the changes that came in South Florida that he was so much a part of. I mean, he had that reputation. He had that reputation in Congress, and so I knew that those were issues that he cared about. What I didn't, and I knew that he was a fighter because you've heard him, you've seen him quoted. What I didn't realize, and I think you can't unless you're really with someone every day, is that in addition to being such a staunch advocate, if Alcee was your friend, he was kind and caring and compassionate and wanted to make sure not just that the things that you were working on together were going well, but to make sure that you were doing okay.
Did you ever have to confront him on an issue? I wonder what that was like. Did you ever disagree on something? And because, you know, he's a powerful figure.
Yeah, I have, there were look, there were times where we had discussions about the best way to do things, but you couldn't really get anywhere confronting Al, yelling at Alcee, telling Al, suggesting that he was wrong. We always wanted to do the right thing. He was effective because he knew that he needed to listen to his allies, needed to listen to people that were trying to accomplish the same things he was.
Yeah. What was the biggest fight you ever saw him involved in Congress?
Going back to the role that Alcee played as a civil rights leader, the fight I would actually, I would just point to two. One is just even in with the challenges to Alcee's health, his commitment to moving to helping to respond to what happened last summer, and the fact that after George Floyd was killed, and there was this moment of real awakening and across the broad society that what happened to George Floyd was happening to too many people, too many young black men in particular were being killed often at the hands of police. This was Alcee's lifetime battle. I mean, he was fighting for justice, and even as we tried to advance legislation, ultimately the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, Alcee related this back to so many of the other battles that he was a part of, and he was just fierce about it, and the memories of Alcee in that fight and those fights are the clearest. He also, by the way, some of the things people don't know. I mean, Alcee in South Florida, where we have so many seniors. I watched Alcee fight my colleagues who tried to cut Social Security, and he was not going to let that happen. And we know that Alcee stood up for people, for the voiceless, for people who needed someone to fight for them. Alcee also was a real champion for animals, and doesn't get that much credit for that, the work that he did to protect animals, because he always looked for the opportunity to fight for people who needed fighting for. And that's the same reason. It's the same reason he stood up and waged these battles for racial justice in this country. It's the same way he stood up and fought to protect seniors who needed a voice. And it's the reason that he was such a staunch supporter of human rights all around the world.
Yeah.
For the same reason. And those were the battles that Alcee always stood up in. And yeah, that's what I definitely remember.
Did you see correlations between him and the late Congressman John Lewis? Did they have a close relationship?
I was thinking about this yesterday, not so much, because of their personal relationship, but just because of how hard it is that, you know, another great champion of the civil rights movement has left us, and Alcee. Yeah, Alcee fought in his own ways on for a lot of those same issues, even beyond civil rights. Though, just as Congressman Lewis was right there for our community, for the kids, for our community after the shooting at Stoneman Douglas. Alcee too. I was thinking about this yesterday. Alcee recognized how beautiful it was for these kids from South Florida who stood up because they were tired of seeing people get shot in their schools, and they stood up and they reached out and they worked with kids who found it just as dangerous and worried about being shot on their way to school, and they formed this movement, and Alcee Alcy was right there with them too, just like John Lewis was.
That was Broward Democrat Ted Deutsch discussing the late Congressman Alcy Hastings. With Hastings passing, there's now a political gap in South Florida's congressional delegation. And joining us now, Sun Sentinel reporter Anthony Mann. Anthony, Alcy became known first as a civil rights lawyer, but what were some of the bigger cases that he fought in court? I believe, do we have Anthony Mann there from the Sun Sentinel? All right, we're going to check on that technical connection. Again, we're talking about Congressman Alcy Hastings. Hastings passing, there's now a political gap again in South Florida's congressional delegation, a story that we'll keep up on. We have with us Anthony Mann of the Sun Sentinel joining us now to talk about this. Anthony, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. Anthony, I wanted to talk a little bit about, Alcy as the civil rights lawyer, but what were some of the bigger cases that he fought in court?
Well, the biggest case that I think he was known for was being involved in the case that led to desegregation of public schools in Broward. I mean, that certainly was the thing that probably had the greatest impact and effect. But he was involved in many, many civil rights cases. I mean, even he and his late law partner from back in the day, they even filed, they were both young lawyers in Broward County, and they even filed a suit against a restaurant that was frequented by the courthouse crowd, but that wouldn't serve Black customers. So he had a range of issues that on the civil rights front that he would fought against. And then he was also, and he talked about this, years ago, he was also a master at getting publicity for his efforts. I mean, he thought that publicity and getting attention for what was going on for cases, and then even for running for office in cases that he didn't think would be successful, he thought that would all help build the cause, help his law business, and help bring attention to the actions that he was taking.
Alcy went on to become a federal judge, but that didn't last long. Why not? What happened?
Well, he was accused of corruption and charged with accepting bribes in order to throw a case. Now, after a criminal trial, he was found not guilty and he continued on the bench. But then Congress took up the matter and the House voted to impeach him and the Senate voted to convict him and remove him from office. Interestingly, and this may resonate for people with the latest presidential impeachment that the country went through, they did not add to the punishment, the removal from office. They didn't add what they could have done, which was a bar on ever serving in office in the future, ever serving in federal office in the future. So just a few years later, he ran for a newly created congressional seat and won.
And what do you think was the reason for his success? I mean, when you have something like an impeachment, that sort of thing can stain your career forever. But how do you think he overcame that?
Well, he overcame it by appealing to his constituents. I mean, he was a well-known civil rights advocate and a leader in the African-American community. And with the redistricting that went into effect with the 1992 election, with complicated provisions under changes to the Voting Rights Act, there was a newly created congressional district that was designed to increase the chances that a Black lawmaker could be elected. And so he had a favorable district, and then he worked at it. He was a charismatic speaker. He represented what his constituents want. His constituents rewarded him time after time. I mean, I looked back at all of his election results, and there were plenty of times the Republicans didn't bother to run anybody against him. But even when they did, he consistently ran up big margins. Occasionally, somebody would challenge him in a primary, and that primary challenger would be defeated by huge margins also. He was he was very popular with his constituency.
Beyond civil rights, how else do you think Hastings is going to be remembered, especially in Congress?
I think he's going to be remembered as somebody, and Congressman Deutsch touched on this, he was a fierce orator, and he was very, very funny. I think covering him not in Congress, not being in D.C., but here in South Florida, I mean, the thing that I most remember about him is how great a speech he could deliver, how tough he could be, and how funny he could be, and not caring if he made people mad. I think that also touched on something that you were touching on with Congressman Deutsch. There wasn't a lot that people who were mad at Congressman Hastings could do to him to get back at him. And so I think that gave him a freedom to speak his mind, and he often spoke his mind.
So what's the process now? Because as we mentioned, this leaves a gap. There's a seat now open. What happens in this process to replace him, and have any challengers thrown their name out there?
Well, the process is fairly simple. Under the Constitution, Governor DeSantis, there has to be an election to replace a member of Congress, and Governor DeSantis picks the election date. Under Florida law, he has a lot of discretion to set the date for the special primary election and then the special general election that will fill the seat. And given that the margin in the U.S. House is relatively tight, the Democrats don't have a lot of extra votes to play with, there's no reason to think that Governor DeSantis, who's a Republican after all, is going to rush to set that election date, because it is virtually guaranteed that a Democrat will replace Congressman Hastings. I mean, there'd have to be something unimaginable given the political makeup of that district for anyone other but a Democrat to win. So Governor DeSantis will set an election date.
And have we heard anything about when he might?
No, we haven't. And he doesn't, he's under no rush. He's under no compulsion to do anything quickly. And politically for the Republicans, it is frankly in their interest to let that seat sit vacant for as long as they want.
That in of itself is an interesting story that we'll look at in the future. But again, speaking with the Sun Sentinel's Anthony Mann, learn more about the late Congressman Alcee Hastings by going to WLRN.org. Anthony, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, still to come, if you had to rebuild your city in South Florida, what would you do differently? How could you make it more sustainable? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Nearly 1,000 people are moving to the Sunshine State every day, and half of them are coming to South Florida. This increased demand for housing is welcome news for developers seeking to revitalize neighborhoods and transform existing communities for these new residents. But can that development be done sustainably? Tony Cho is the CEO of Metro One, a real estate firm behind a number of key projects here in South Florida, including the Magic City Innovation District and parts of Wynwood. Last week, Cho launched the Future of Cities Project, a global initiative to look at development in 20 different cities through a sustainable and regenerative lens. Tony, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here with you in my hometown of Miami. So thanks for having me on your show.
Well, you know what? I'm wondering, you've been working on in development across South Florida for a while now. But when you look at it just across the board, how would you rate, you know, the way we've been growing and developing? Are we doing it the right way? Is it intelligent, development? Is it sustainable?
No, I don't think it's sustainable in Florida and Miami in particular, but I don't think it's sustainable in very many places. And I think that, you know, the real estate development community is not equipped with the resources, and the education around how do we build more sustainably. And I think we've gotten to a point where if we continue to develop the way that we've developed over the last couple hundred years, particularly in the last century, we're going to get to a point where we can't, you know, we can't go back from the damage that we've caused with CO2 emissions and climate change. So over the next 30 years, the UN forecasts that the built environment will double in size. And if we continue using the same building materials and methodologies as we have for the last 100 years plus, then we're not going to be able to achieve our sustainable development goals. And I think that is kind of the genesis of why I launched the Future of Cities.
You know what you talk about? I mean, we can't continue what we've been doing for the last 100 years. Can you give me an example like of an area and you could say, look, that's how we should not be doing it? Or is that everywhere?
Well, I think, listen, you know, if we don't plan for the growth, particularly that's happening in Florida, and I think there's actually 1,500 people a day since the pandemic moving to Florida. I think those numbers have increased. If we don't plan for regional, you know, local, statewide development, then we're not going to plan for the inevitable negative consequences of development, which is loss of biodiversity, intensive traffic, you know, reduction in quality of life, and all those types of things that we're encountering here in South Florida. I mean, the good news is with technology, resources, and innovation, you know, we should be at the forefront of prototyping solutions for climate change. You know, they're 3D printing, you know, 4- and 5-story buildings now. If we invest more resources into innovation and really be thoughtful about the way we're building our cities, our buildings, and communities, I think we're going to have a much better outcome.
You know, it's something that hit me, I think about every time I talk to developers, and especially we talk about South Florida, a lot of people keep coming down here. That's true. And we're expecting, I mean, hundreds of thousands over the next decade. Do you ever see a situation where sustainability means close the door and say no more people can come in because it wouldn't be sustainable?
You know, that's an interesting question. You know, I'm of the opinion that we have all of the tools and the resources to innovate. You know, I believe in human ingenuity, and I believe that in innovation. And I believe, particularly with the influx of all the, you know, intellectual capital and tech people moving here, you know, that are investing a lot of money in real estate in particular and establishing residency here. I think that it's really time to put together you know, a think tank around climate change solutions. And I think that, you know, that is something that I think, you know, needs to be workshopped at a local, regional, and statewide initiative. What is too much for us? And, you know, for me in particular, I'm an urban developer, but I'm very interested and passionate about the Florida wildlife corridors. As a developer, you know, I want to conserve all the biodiversity, you know, using the Florida panther as an emblem for wild Florida. So if we just have suburban sprawl, you know, we have all these subdivisions throughout kind of our biodiverse rich center of the state, which we call the Florida Wildlife Corridor, basically from the Everglades all the way up to Georgia, we're going to be losing biodiversity. And I think that that's an amenity that is going to, you know, impact the value of our real estate on the coast, which is the concentration of more of the density. So I think our approach is more of a holistic approach where it's much more integrated and holistic in the term, in the way that we plan. I'm very pro-density, but really smart, progressive zoning policies that allow for things, you know, parking, for example. You know, there's been a big debate about parking, you know, and parking garages most likely will be obsolete in the next 10, 20, 30 years with the advent of autonomous vehicles. And there's not a lot of discussions happening at the building departments and the planning departments around how do we repurpose parking garages in the future? What does that look like?
Yeah, we're still trying to figure out what to do with department stores and malls that empty out and they just sit there. You were one of the founders of the Wynwood Business Improvement District. This is a neighborhood now that's one of the top tourism locations in the state, probably in the country. I mean, 4 million visitors in 2019. As a developer, how do you determine success of a neighborhood? Is it visitor revenue? Is it long-term residential communities? Is it, you know, that branding? Well, what's success to you?
So I think there are different metrics for success, right? There's commercial and economic success. There's cultural success. You know, there's environmental success and there's social success. And I think Wynwood has checked a lot of the boxes. I think Wynwood has brought a cultural revolution of sorts, you know, in the street art movement around the country and around the world, of which I'm very proud to have played a role in and have been a part of. What pains me a little bit is that the artists and the galleries and the independent businesses that, you know, help co-create Wynwood, most of them can't afford to remain in Wynwood. And I think that is a challenge that we're looking to address and workshop with Future of Cities through alternative methods of ownership, through cooperatives, through public-private partnerships, opportunity zones, access, you know, et cetera. And the social impact as well. There's not really affordable, attainable housing anywhere in Miami.
Yeah.
And so I think we're a victim of our success. I think the average home price in South Florida is now somewhere hovering around $425,000.
Exactly. Yeah, I was about to bring this up. I mean, look, the success in Wynwood has led to this expansion now into like the Little Haiti neighborhood. And your firm, Metro One, is also behind the Magic City Innovation District, and that's new development, and then that features high-rises and some luxury housing in that neighborhood. So in the case of both the Magic City and Wynwood, you're increasing property values as a result of the development. Great, you bring a lot of people in, more money, more opportunity, but that also leads to that word people don't like, gentrification. What happens to those folks? You have people that have been living in those neighborhoods for a long time. Now they can't afford to be there. So as a developer, you said you're concerned about it, but how do you preserve the culture of a neighborhood, the history, you know, and those folks, or not, and not just shove them out because, well, you know, new high rises, that's good money.
I think there's natural economic forces and inertia. All property values in Florida are rising, urban, suburban, rural, et cetera. You know, we're accelerating a transformation of an underdeveloped, underinvested neighborhood for 50 years. And so we're, just to clarify, we're not building any luxury housing. It's all market rate, smaller format apartments, all for rent, no luxury condos. And I think what is I'm proud of with the Magic City Innovation District in Little Haiti is the partnership that we were able to forge with the local community and with the city of Miami. We made a historic public benefits contribution of almost, you know, $40 million that's forecasted to be contributed over the course of the development. That is a new type of structure where all of those funds, and we've already made our first $3 million payment. We have a second $3 million payment in the next 6 months or so. And that money is all funneling directly into the community of Little Haiti through a mechanism that was created as a result of this project called the Little Haiti Trust, where the community gets to determine where those resources are allocated. And of course, top of that list is affordable housing, job training and education, and cultural preservation. So I'm proud that, yes, we're investing in developing this neighborhood. We can't control speculators, but what we can do is the right thing. But I don't think that developers should be solely responsible for solving all the world's problems. And I strongly believe in public-private partnership and that all the world's problems require cross-sector collaboration at an unprecedented scale. You know, we haven't received any local, state, federal incentives to do what we're doing. And I think we're making a very positive impact in that community. And there's things, nothing is perfect. You know, we're learning, we're making mistakes, we're learning along the way, but our intentions are authentic and good, and we want to uplift the community. And I think we just did we gave a scholarship to Florida Memorial University, and, you know, to really be able to provide an opportunity for Haitian students to be able to study technology at a historically Black college and university, which is Florida Memorial University.
I'm going to go back to something you said, something very interesting. I don't want to put it on developers to say it solved the world's problems, but let's look at development in South Florida and the role developers play. And I know they're all different. I'm not putting all of them in the same bucket, but this is a very hot market. It's a hot market where a lot of people want to move here from all over the country and all over the world. And so that means there's a lot of money. And so, you know, coming back to this idea is like, how do you protect neighborhoods knowing that, hey, listen, another developer could come in and say, yeah, this is a really great area. I can knock all this down and I can put up something much more expensive, bring in better money for the community. I mean, in the end, how do you win out over that need for more money? The desire for more money.
Yeah, I think that's where you need to level the playing field with better incentives. And I think that comes from the public sector, from public-private partnerships. And developers who are willing to do socially and environmentally innovative projects should have the same opportunity to make as much money, if not more, than a developer doing a luxury condo. And so those incentives are not aligned properly. Same thing with opportunity zones. You know, there's an opportunity to really revitalize 8,700 underserved, poor, economically depressed areas in this country. And without the appropriate guardrails and metrics for measuring that, and without the right incentives to get people to do that, and without lowering the cost of construction and materials and innovating and building material sciences, we're not going to be able to accomplish our goals. It's to everybody's benefit to have attainable, affordable housing. Miami will reach a ceiling where we have all this demand and all this money coming in, and all these companies that want to move here will be making decisions. If they can't find affordable housing for their employees, then they're going to go to other places where there are more affordable housing options. So to me, it is a priority, and all developers and all public policymakers should be focused on this. And we should be working together to align incentives to be able to incentivize people to do, and it's not just to do affordable housing and tax credit. The system is broken. It's not working, right?
Right. No, there is a lot to this. And again, I'm not going to put all developers in the same bucket. Again, talking with Tony Cho, Miami developer, and he's behind the firm Metro One. He recently launched the Future of Cities platform. It's a massive international project which seeks to develop sustainably in cities across the globe. You can read more about it on our social media, WLRN Sundial. I want to ask you about this Future of Cities concept centered around this idea of sustainable development. Are you talking about environmental sustainability or economic, cultural? How do you bring it together?
ESG strategies. So basically our theory is that through leveraging ESG strategies, public-private partnerships, and a forward view on how we're looking at developing communities, buildings, cities, et cetera, we can achieve outsized returns. But we have to be innovative, we have to be collaborative, and we have to be creative. And so basically there's three components to this platform. There's a real estate investment and development company that's focused on impact, leveraging opportunity zones and public-private partnerships. You know, initially we're focused on the US and regionally in the Sunbelt states. And we've already invested in another project in Florida. We're not ready to announce. That will be our first demonstration project. But then the second component is a think tank and an advocacy group that's really focused on popularizing and open sourcing best practices around regenerative development, demonstration projects from around the world, thought leadership and white papers. You know, we're doing our first virtual event on April 20th, you know, in advance of Earth Day, called Rewilding Cities. And we have luminaries such as Bill Holmgren, who is a pioneer of permaculture, Deepak Chopra in consciousness, and bringing different perspectives together to really workshop ideas. And this is really focused on bringing nature back into cities and biomimicry. And then the third component is a venture ecosystem, because we believe that we have to invest in technologies and evolutionary companies that are focused on solving, and small businesses that are focused on solving big challenges like climate change.
And you have those folks, but to what extent are you working with like political leaders, advocates, citizens within the community where that development is being planned?
So it's central to our whole thesis and our platform. And so we, you know, for example, the director of sustainability from the city of Orlando is on our board of advisors. And, you know, we launched with about 15 board, you know, advisors, and that's going to be growing and diversifying in perspectives and region and areas. And so we have everybody from, you know, futurists, urban planners, policymakers, artists, a diverse perspective around what communities need. And I think that's part of what is going to make this platform different, and that it's a fully participatory, inclusive process in how we think about problems and how we think about development. And so when we go to look at a project, normally a developer says, you know, I'm going to develop this product type, this asset class. I have a vision of what this community needs, without necessarily taking the right steps to really synthesize and deeply listen, you know, from a diverse group of stakeholders, and then synthesizing that information, and then let the project be emergent, so to speak, to what are the best cases, and then looking at the economics of it and figuring out where the gaps are and where you need to plug in that public-private partnership and those incentives.
Let me finish with this. I'm coming back to this. You know, South Florida, as you know, this is your hometown. here in Miami, but South Florida in general, from West Palm all the way down, has developed pretty much the same way. And it's just growth, 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 because it's, again, a lot of people want to come down here. Briefly, if you could go back and redo something, one thing, how would you have done something differently in that development, in the growth of these cities here in this region?
Great question. I would have asked that there was much more communication and collaboration between and among the region, you know, the Tri-County area, for example, all the municipalities. When you look at transportation and education and your urban development plans, I think that, you know, people have been operating for the most part in silos. I know that now there's a lot more collaboration. You have initiatives like Brightline that's really connecting high-speed rail throughout the state. And there's many other opportunities. And I think really the technology wasn't there yet, but now there are solutions that we can prototype. So I don't think it's too late. I'm optimistic. And I believe that Florida should be the laboratory where we can prototype and scale climate solutions for the built environment like no other place in the world. We want to be an example. And I think we now have, you know, the talent here, the intellectual capital, the financial capital, you know, it's the capital of capital, according to Mayor Suarez. And I think that that gives us an opportunity to really correct some of the challenges that poor planning and lack of vision and lack of focus on, you know, triple bottom line result can accomplish.
And that's what we have to do. We don't have much of a choice now with, as you mentioned, with the climate crisis. We don't have much of a choice. We have to make those changes soon. Tony Cho, Miami developer, real estate mogul behind the firm Metro One. Read more about his Future of Cities platform on our social media, WLR and Sundial. Tony, thank you so much. Lots of interesting ideas to talk about. Got to have you back.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Still to come. When's the last time you wrote a letter on paper and mailed it with a stamp? We're going to tell you about a letter writing campaign across the Americas through the O Miami Poetry Festival. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Let's take a moment to remember the world before the pandemic. What did you miss most? Traveling was a big one, right? Learning about new cultures, meeting new people, just basic human interaction. The O Miami Poetry Festival has an international letter exchange that can help you travel while still staying safely at home. Poets across the Americas will write you a personal letter that you can share. Perhaps it'll inspire you to write your own and send it off. Well, joining us now, the creators of that project, Liliana Ortega Camarena. Liliana, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Also joining us is Julia Taveras, joining us as well, part of this program. Julia, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Liliana, let me start with you. I'm wondering what inspired this letter exchange project? Where did this come from?
Well, definitely the pandemic. I feel like globally we have all been feeling very similarly when it comes to isolation, not being able to see your friends or family, especially if you don't live close to your family. So that's a big part of it. It's also been on my own personal experiences and my relationship with Julia. Julia and I know each other since like puberty, since high school. Yeah, and even since that age, we pretty much had like little collabs here and there. But our relationship has continued to exist and grow, even though we've always been at different points of the world. Like, we're both from Puerto Rico, and that's where we went to high school. But afterwards, Julia went off to study in New York. I am currently living in Miami at the moment. And our relationship was always on and off. We would catch up again. It was always through writing as well.
Right.
And during the pandemic, it resurged. And personally as well, during the pandemic, I also lost my grandmother. Yeah, thankfully it's not due to COVID, but COVID did make the situation very difficult in that, you know, she died isolated in a hospital. We weren't able to necessarily say her last goodbyes. Even the funeral proceedings were very complicated.
Yeah.
So it was that personal need of connection and like Julia and I reconnecting once again during the pandemic, that just, I feel like I'm not the only one that has lost family during the pandemic. No, so, no. Yeah, you know, and, so yeah, this is pretty much it.
and Julia, you know, because this goes to the whole mental health part of it too, this connection mm-hmm. and the mental health, it's a really big part of the project. What's the past year been like for you?
So on a, it's interesting that you asked that because on a personal level, 2020 was not bad for me. I got a new job. I finished my master's. I didn't have any, but in the past years in 2014, 2015 and 2019, I suffered psychosis episodes and I have been very vocal about my experience with mental health. And, you know, the diagnosis and the treatment and all that. So when 2020 rolled around and I felt like everybody was having a really hard time, I was like, whoa, I'm actually kind of prepared because my world has already ended three times. Like I've already gone through like such serious crises that I can actually navigate this because I have been empowered with, you know, with tools through therapy and through just destigmatizing, you know, depression or anxiety. And speaking about it, you know, in Puerto Rico, they maybe 2 months or 3 months after lockdown happened, two friends of friends, not people that I knew directly, but two acquaintances took their lives. And it started to sink in that if you had an imbalance before, the isolation would exacerbate whatever existing conditions you had.
Now the pandemic has taken its toll in so many ways. I'm sorry to both of you for your losses. But it brought you together, brought you back together, pandemic in communicating, and that's led to this project. Now, Julia, I start with you. How does this work exactly? This is, and as I said, this is letter writing. This isn't just mm-hmm. sending off a text. You know, we're going back to the old ways, you know, with a pen and paper. But how did it start and who are you sending these letters to?
So the target audience is the Miami-Dade community, but anybody in the U.S. can sign up to receive a letter. Although since this is sponsored by Oh Miami, it is, you know, targeted towards the Miami community. But so how it works is we have a list of poets that we curated from all across the continent. They are in the process of sending us letters based off of a series of writing prompts that we sent to them. And some of these letters, since they're written in the person's native language, they have be translated. That's where I come in. I'll be translating a lot of letters from Spanish, Portuguese, and French into English. And then we will, once we receive these letters, which will be written, they will be handled digitally, a series of volunteers will transcribe these letters and send them out to the people that sign up for the project. So if you are in the area and you want to receive a letter and from somebody that you don't know, which, you know, it can be kind of weird, but it's also kind of exciting because, like, at least with the pandemic and in life, I get a lot of, you know, WhatsApps and iMessages, and we're constantly getting messages from all sorts of platforms, but still showing up to my mailbox I can't explain it. It's so thrilling to get mail.
Exactly. No, I know the feeling. I remember writing letters. We have an excerpt, by the way, from one of those letters. Let's take a listen. This is from, written by Sarah Safi.
Dear fellow human, the most meaningful interaction I've had with a stranger that occurred recently was a phone call with a customer service representative across the globe. It all started with the representative apologizing for the rooster crowing in the background. He was working from home due to COVID numbers. Personally, the rooster reminded me of my own roots and the peace of life where my own family comes from.
Julia, this again, these are letters. This is taking place just in the Americas, but you know, as we heard, it's folks here in Miami. And actually, you know what, Liliana, I was wondering, how did you guys decide then that it would be between here and Puerto Rico?
Well, pretty much It's beyond that. We wanted to just craft that need for connection that we felt individually and that we've been healing collectively. So we figured the best way to connect would be through the entire American continent. So we do have poets from Puerto Rico. We also have poets from Brazil. We have poets from French-speaking territories as well. So pretty much it's a double-edged sword, so to speak, because we do, as Latina women, definitely want to help people in Miami-Dade expand their horizons as to what America truly is, which is more than the United States. It's an entire continent, very rich in culture and multiple languages. But yeah, that's pretty much it.
Again, talking with Liliana Ortega Camarena and Julia Taveras, they are the creators of O Miami Poetry Festival's International Letter Exchange Project. It's titled Add Attachment. By the way, you could sign up to receive a letter at omiami.org, the deadline April 18th. You can also find more information about the project on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Julia, the written letters, again, because you were touching on this, this is very different than when we get texts and messages online on our phones. It's very personal. A letter's personal. It's intimate. It's different. What are some of the responses that you've heard from people and maybe even some of the stories that you've been reading?
We're only receiving, like we have just begun sending out the writing prompts to the poets, and we have just received, I think only two. It was the one that you read the excerpt from, which was a very personal account of actually a friend of mine who lives out in California, who is a musician, and she got asked to write about the last time. The prompt that she got was, when was the last time that you fruitfully connected with a stranger? So she wrote about that experience, connecting with a customer and representative, which has happened.
Yeah.
If I can add, the prompt that Julia is talking about, we designed from scratch. Like, we pretty much just had a writing session. The purpose of them is just trying to incentivize connection and trying to inspire poets to let their poetry become their method of caretaking for these people that would be receiving the letters. And then also, at least when it comes to the recipient sign up, as you said, people can sign up at omiami.org/submit. We have an optional prompt. So it's not, you know, people don't have to necessarily fill it out, but it's a prompt that we wanted to convey, which is, what makes you a good neighbor? And the people that we've had sign up thus far have actually, all of them, decided to answer the question. And we've gotten some really heartwarming and wholesome responses, which definitely have validated my feeling like this will be, you know, effective and will help people in Miami-Dade come to terms with these isolation blues.
This is a beautiful project. What a wonderful project. And going back again to just writing letters, I know something my generation knows all too well. Again, I want to thank my guests, Julia Taveras and Liliana Ortega Camarena, again, creators of the O Miami Poetry Festival's International Letter Exchange. The project is called Add Attachment. Learn more on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Julia, Liliana, thank you so much and best of luck going forward.
Thank you so
much.
Thank
you.
And by the way, I want to remind you, and you or someone you know is in crisis, help is available. You can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255. I know this pandemic has taken a toll on so many. Well, for many years now, WLRN has partnered with the O Miami Poetry Festival in April to celebrate National Poetry Month. We're inviting you to write short poems about your community. We call them Zip Odes, an ode to your zip code. Writing a zip code is easy. Start with your 5-digit zip code. Write a 5-line poem. Each digit of your zip code tells you how many words per line. Here are some examples. This one is from Liliana Hernandez. She lives in Hialeah.
Hialeah's too much. I should know. ... I am too.
That's 33012. This one is from Diego Abreu. He lives in Flagler, in the Flagler area. His zip code is 33135.
Cortaditos for All is my platform when campaigning for president of the Republic of Miami.
And this one is from Juliana Clark. She's an elementary school teacher. Her zip code 33150.
It is hot. I am sweaty. Always, my mom is tired.
Submitting your zip code is easy. We have a zip code tool to help you read your poem at WLRN.org/zip codes. And that's this program for Wednesday, April 7th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we get an update on the coronavirus in Puerto Rico. As vaccine doses make their way to the island, who has been able to get the access to those vaccines? Plus, the Miami Jewish Film Festival kicks off next week. It's going to be probably the biggest it's ever been, even though you won't be able to see all of the movies at a theater. We'll find out all about that coming up tomorrow. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Again, as always, be safe, be good to each other. We're going to talk to you again live tomorrow. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.